Hello, everyone. Welcome back to Sabbath School from Home. My name's Cameron.
And I'm Lachlan.
Luke and Ken couldn't join us. Schedules don't seem to be getting any easier to align, Lock, but hopefully they'll be joining us next week.
Well, I have great sympathies for all of that. I've just spent the day driving after returning home from a fun Easter long weekend holiday with the family. So it's great to be here, but I do come a little weary.
Yeah. Lock, this is our first episode of our fifth year doing the podcast.
Yeah, I was reflecting on that as well. We've now recorded 4 years straight of a Sabbath School discussion every week.
Yeah.
Which is a pretty amazing thing, to be honest.
Yeah, that's right. And hopefully many more exciting and interesting episodes in front of us. Lock, this quarter is on the Great Controversy. And I'd like to nominate something a little different for this quarter, it is this. There was a book written called The Great Marriage, and the thesis of this book was about, I've not read it, so I'm based on what I know from references to this book, was that good and evil exists as opposite sides of the same coin, and that we know good by its contrast to evil, and that to imagine a world of good without any evil is, you know, pie in the sky. And C.S. Lewis wrote a book in reply called The Great Divorce. And it is a small book. It's about 13 chapters, 14 chapters, but the last chapter is very short. And so I suggest that over this episode and the next 12, while we're looking at the sort of big picture themes of good and evil, our listeners should find, buy, or download a copy of The Great Divorce, and it's a very small amount. We can throw in a small section, maybe 5-10 minutes at the start of each episode, that's by way of a book reading club. I was going to say book review. It's not a review. I'll set the scene. The scene starts in a very large city where there are some very discontent and squabbling members of the city's populace waiting for a bus, and the narrator is among them. And as the story emerges, it turns out that this bus travels weekly from hell to heaven. And
it's already a great start.
And we won't talk any more about that. Look, I think that following the themes of large questions, we should focus on some large questions. The lesson asks some really good questions, and the lesson asks some questions which are just as good but are based on premises that I think themselves can be questioned. Let's just dive into it. You've picked out some from near the end of this week's lesson, and I had some from near the start. So I'm going to claim precedence because mine are found in the very first paragraph. Yeah. First question. This is the opening to this topic. If God is so good, why is the world so bad? So what's the point of agreement? Because this is a question that needs answering, but the question is based on a premise that the questioner assumes they and I hold in common.
Yeah, it's assumed that we all agree the world is so bad.
How bad is so bad?
Yeah. If you've listened to other episodes of the podcast, you may remember that this is one of my personal sort of points of provocation. I think that Adventists in particular, not perhaps totally uniquely, but more so than many other Christians, like to point and emphasize on the badness of the world. The reason for doing this is to more firmly motivate the soon return of Christ, because that idea should, of course, be attractive to all people at all times, but it feels more attractive if one is dwelling on how bad things are here and how much the world needs rescuing. And there's a certain element in that I think makes logical sense and matches observation. Everyone can tell pretty powerful stories of suffering, of pain, of badness in life. But it has to be recognized that there's also a certain amount of inexplicable goodness. And so your question, how bad is so bad, is actually a really important question. The first question simply here has to be, is the world more bad than it is good?
Well, how about this question, Locke? If the devil is so evil, why is the world so good?
Yes. I mean, that's a great inversion of the question.
He's the prince of this world, yeah. And why are there people like Anne Frank sheltering Jews in the attic during the Holocaust? And why are there people like Beethoven emerging from horrific, dysfunction in society and being having these, congenital deafness that develops, but it's something probably related to, I think his mother had syphilis. I can't remember. But there's illness and there's depravity and there's poor circumstance and there's a struggling life, and out of it all pops the pathetic or the Emperor Concerto or the Ode to Joy. And so, and you look at Van Gogh and you say, well, here's someone who's so depressed. And the devil seems to have, if you would have borrowed some great controversy narrative, seems to have had a fairly free rein in terms of Van Gogh's mental health. Mm. Why is it that this mental health problems gave birth to pictures of such vibrance and colour? Yeah,
that connect with and speak to so many people.
Yeah. Why Schumann?
Yeah.
Schumann died in an asylum. I mean, this is a story that I think a lot about. And Schumann's wife supported, had 8 kids to look after, and supported not only them but her husband's memory as he died insane in an asylum. And the devotion that represents, apart from the beauty of his music, is a thing which is exquisitely good. So the question needs to be asked the other way around. If the devil is so evil, why is the world so good?
And let's just acknowledge right here, maybe we could be criticized as being people in a privileged experience of life with, you and I are reflecting just recently. It is remarkable to be, this year I turned 40 and all 4 of my grandparents are still alive. That's a fairly special perspective on life. I recognize that.
And not just but alive, some of them subscribe to this podcast. They're participating and involved and interested in helping people out in the aged care facilities where they live. And
No, exactly. And so I am prepared to have leveled at me the accusation, the only reason you're asking this question is because you're living a fairly charmed life. But I think what you're referring to is the somewhat, like, almost universally perceived goodness. I mentioned before we started recording the very, very widespread sensation of awe, wonder, majesty, excitement when you reach the summit of a tall mountain and look out at the view. That's something which is good.
There's
really good.
There's a whole rabbit hole on YouTube that's well worth going into of babies laughing at things. And so, deep belly laughs, little kids like 6 months old, 8 months old, losing it when their parents rip a sheet of paper in half, or when their mum makes a funny noise or sneezes and blows her nose. And it's like a new experience. And so the laughter is, they're fun moments, but they're so universally good. You see in that moment, that just totally unsullied, spontaneous, the paper's been ripped in half and it made a funny noise, and that's just so awesome. It's no wonder these things garner millions of views. And I would say that they are not good merely in a trivial sense. They hint at something about existence which is there. It does not mean that evil is less evil.
Yeah, yeah. It's not minimizing the evil in the world, but it is, on the contrary, I suspect that sometimes the narratives that start with the assumption the world is so bad might actually risk minimizing
the good
that is in the world.
And of course, people who are in times of trial, I can personally attest to this, that I do not, and I think it's statistically, empirically the case, that people in trials do not tend to despair of the goodness in the universe more than people out of trials. And there is a sort of generalized anxiety and depression that is prevalent amongst people are pretty safe fundamentally. That, you know, it's real food for thought. So when you say, oh, it's all very well for you there in your rich, sheltered life to dismiss the problem of pain, but what about the people who are in it? Well, the people who are in it could just as well say, it's all very well, you know, look at these poor people there. They have no dangers they have to face, no problems they have to solve. Obviously, I am, what I'm saying now is insensitive to people who are in genuine problems. But empirically, the people who have no problems often lead very miserable lives. And and Tim Minchin said this in a speech once. He got up and said to some graduates, he said, I'm looking out at some people who are smart enough to get a university degree. You guys will earn a comfortable living. By and large, you'll be able to keep yourself safe and you can expect to live a long time. And so, of course, you can all expect at one point to end up depressed. And everyone laughed, but he was making a serious point. There's some sort of empirical basis for that. You know, I do find this nuance. If you, and it really is the question you have to ask at the very start, Locke, because if the universe is so bad, then God has a lot to answer for. And you now need to explain, why did he allow creatures with free will? Why did he plant the tree? Why did he plant both trees? Why not just the tree of life? Why did he do this? Why did he do this? And the reason why the question is so important, and we have to be so careful to phrase it in a way that doesn't compromise God's character, and the lesson, you know, God is a God of incredible love, it says. It's in his very nature to love. All of his actions are loving. This is what it says in answer to this question. If God is so good, why is the world so bad? If the world is so bad, is it possible to let God off the hook?
Yeah.
You know, isn't this, you know, are you trying to knock down a straw man that you've suddenly discovered he's not made of straw, he's made of bricks?
Well, this is one of the things that I like to dwell on a little bit. You know, there's many, many things that have been said, written, argued, thought about the creation narrative in Genesis, or narratives in Genesis, depending how you identify and count them. But the Genesis 1 account has a rhythmic structure that repeats the idea that it's good and reinforces it with the climax that it's very good. And I think we're genuinely called, you know, at least at times in life, to ponder the goodness. The goodness of what God has done and what God has created. And it doesn't deny the deficiencies in our experience of that goodness, the lack of universal goodness and the lack of consistent goodness, if I can express it that way in life. But those caveats don't take away from the fact, as we've tried to identify by alluding to some fairly universal human experiences of the goodness. And let's face it, by and large, the majority of people do feel that existing is better than not existing.
John Cleese's mum lived to about 100. And so John Cleese was part of the Monty Python group. And for the last decades upon decades, he would ring her up and he'd say, well, mum, how are you? And she'd say, well, you know, John, as if it was a surprise after 30 years, I'm not doing so well. I'm feeling a little poorly. And she'd been feeling poorly for half a century. Like, and he got a bit tired of it at one stage, and she had, you know, depression. And eventually he said, well, mum, he said, if you want to, and only if you want to, I do have a friend, actually, who lives down in Lewisham, and possibly not this Sunday, but the next Sunday, if you like, he could come up and kill you. And she thought it was hilarious, which shows a little bit of where John Cleese's humour came from. She thought it was it was really funny. But, I mean, that response is really taking it at face value. If the world is so bad, there's...
And, you know, I guess all I'm trying to demonstrate here is that there certainly are people who feel ultimate despair, but the majority of people empirically identify goodness. So when we start with this question, if God is so good, why is the world so bad? We could just as easily ask the question that you flipped around. If the world is the realm of the devil, then why isn't it
worse?
All bad. Why is it so good? Why is it as good as it is? So that's an interesting question. Of course, it takes us straight through to, you know, we're talking about Genesis. It takes us through to chapter 2, the bit in Genesis where God plants the garden. You know, chapter 2, verse 8, and 9. And the Lord planted a garden in Eden, in the east. And there he put the man whom he had formed. Out of the ground the Lord God made to spring up every tree that is pleasant to the sight and good for food. The tree of life was in the midst of the garden, and the tree of the knowledge of good and evil.
Now, I made the comment, and our listeners can take issue with this, but I've said this before, I'm going to say it again. We all, story is the lens that we use to explain the world. And we attach story meaning through stories. And the stories, some of them are stories that have happened, some of them are stories from our experience, and some of them are fictional stories, such as Christ used with the parable. They are all equally potent for making, and we don't really differentiate between whether the story is a true one or not when we apply it to our life. So the trivial example is when you walk through a playground and you'll hear kids say, oh, it's just like in Indiana Jones, you know, or I did this fully sick thing, trick thing, and it was just like in, you know, some adventure film or some video they've seen in YouTube. But it was just like the story is the stable point, and existence is the fluctuating, complicated, confusing thing, which is made sense of by referring it back to the story. Yeah. The way this story plays out in Adventist narrative is how God creates these trees. The first couple is tasked with just looking after the garden, and all the trees, incidentally, are good, pleasing to the sight and good for food. So when Eve notices that the tree of knowledge of good and evil is pleasing to the eye and good for food, which she does in chapter 3, that is not to say that God made this tree especially tempting. It is to say that this tree was just like every other tree. But then in terms of the great controversy, like, spell out to me, how does this narrative play out?
Well, a little bit off the cuff, so if you feel I'm not treating this well, write into us, sabbathschoolfromhome@gmail.com. But this is where the great hinge point is placed into the story, right? Because there is no evil, there is no badness, and here is this point where Adam and Eve can choose to either follow God's instruction or reject God's instruction and follow another path. And the curiosity, the temptation, they do. They choose to eat of the forbidden tree, and that brings into the world a great evilness.
Yeah, and that great evilness is inherited by all their offspring.
But not only all their offspring, the great evilness is imposed upon all of the world, because the fields grow thorns. It is not merely the human experience that is tainted, but rather the entirety of creation in perpetuity through inheritance.
Yeah.
And this is a state then which requires repair of the connection back to God. And so the great controversy unfolds as there's this. I mean, I'm skipping out the whole bit. This is the point in the great controversy where the first humans inadvertently, if I can say it that way, find that they have sided with the deceiver.
Maybe not inadvertently, but they're all bad choices are inadvertent in the sense that if you really knew.
Yes.
Well, were they inadvertent? Well, this is the question, isn't it? I mean,
I guess what I mean by inadvertently is that the serpent doesn't say in the story, reject God and follow me.
Yes.
Become my followers.
Yeah.
That is implied in the sense that the serpent is offering a suggestion, and the suggestion is in deviance from God's instruction.
Yeah.
But it is not posed as a choice of ruler.
And it's not.
It is merely posed as, are you curious? And can you really trust God? In other words, that's what I meant by inadvertent.
It's certainly not posited to be a great hinging point which will affect their children and all the animals and plants and everything that they see around them. And in point of fact, in the original verse, in verse 17, God says, if you eat of the tree that day, you will surely die. God does not in fact pronounce judgment on their offspring or there won't be any offspring.
I mean, at face value, if we can read in a little bit of speculation, at face value, that makes it sound as if they will die and the garden and creation, because they die, the garden and creation will then be cleansed of the evilness and be able to continue in its state. So in a kind of really bizarre sense, by arguing this particular line a little too a little too hard, I suppose. I've ended up saying that because God didn't kill Adam and Eve that day, yeah. as he had initially promised, yeah. he ended up dooming all of the yeah. creation
yeah.
to suffering, as the New Testament writer puts it, groaning
yeah.
under the weight of this evil. Again, this is the silly thing. As you start to attempt to, and I think this is where we're trying to get to, yeah. as you start to attempt to articulate the way in which God has placed this choice, you inadvertently keep coming back to what sounds as if God is responsible
yeah.
for the evil in yeah. the world. And that's exactly what the great controversy is attempting to articulate.
Is not the case.
Out of. Yeah. yeah.
I don't think what I'm trying to say is, if we think that by keeping a tight control on the narrative and reassuring ourselves on its minor points and remembering every footnote and cross-reference, that we can somehow reduce this to a thing which is comfortable and safe and need cause us no anguish, I think that's a little naive. It is also the picture you've painted, which is the picture that I've grown up with, it also has some really interesting assumptions. It assumes, Lachlan, that had Adam and Eve not chosen the fruit, that their kids would have automatically found it easy themselves not to take the fruit.
Yeah.
And it assumes that, in point of fact, the only reason you're doing the wrong things you're doing is because these people ate that jolly apple. But, I mean, honestly, would you... I think it is worth asking, in the light of Scripture, is it likely that we would find it any easier to follow God?
Yeah.
If no one before us had chosen to rebel? The possibility would... Like, I don't see...
Well, I know. And in fact, you can go back the other way, right? So you could make the argument, why did God put this tree in the garden?
Yeah.
What if he just created the garden without this tree?
Yeah, of course.
But in the great controversy narrative, prior to the creation of the world, as Adventists yeah. normally tell the story, yeah. Lucifer, a prominent angel,
yeah.
ends up choosing yeah. to rebel against God's way.
The tree exists.
And there is no tree.
There's no tree. There's no tree. Exactly. In heaven, there's no tree of the knowledge of good and evil. But they manage to rebel because the tree is only a proxy.
Yeah,
it's not.
The tree represents what was always there as a possibility from, and this is, I guess, effectively implied by the way this story is usually told. The fact that it was possible for Lucifer to rebel against God in heaven tells that God, when he creates things, is willing to create into that thing a certain level of freedom.
Yeah.
And the tree is a narrative element here that is emphasizing the presence yeah. of that freedom. That the tree is not, like, the freedom exists outside the existence of the tree,
yeah.
I think.
Yeah, and I honestly, what am I trying to say? If, as I know myself, I don't think that it would be easier to follow God just because the people who came before me had followed God. Empirically, I'm not sure if that's the case. So what I'm trying to say is, this great, huge, significant single hinge point in history, I'm much more comfortable. And what's important is, you know, I'm exploring some different directions, but I'm not doing away with the concept of a conflict between good and evil. It's not like I'm saying, let's throw the great controversy out the window and it doesn't really matter. It's just that I see it as a story that plays out moment by moment in me. All the time.
Yeah. So I guess one of the conventional comments here, Cam, would be that that's because you are in a fallen state of being human and that there's a categorically different essence to being in an unfallen state, which I will agree with to some extent, but clearly in their unfallen state, Adam and Eve had the potential to choose to deviate from God's plan. And even in the Gospels, Jesus is tempted. Now, for that temptation in the wilderness to mean anything, it's surely meaning something precisely because Jesus also had the option,
yeah.
the freedom to deviate
yeah.
from the way and the will of God. However you can say that and make sense of it, because he also is God. Yeah. But the point that I am making is, if we are seeing in Christ a unfallen representative of humanity,
yeah.
then that unfallen representative of humanity has to struggle with exactly the same decision, exactly the same temptation, exactly the same fundamental reality as we read with Eve and Adam in Genesis 3, as must have existed for Lucifer in the in the heavenly realm. It seems to be, and so this speaks to one of the questions. It doesn't really answer it. It just is a useful perspective on one of the questions that this week's lesson asks. If God knew that Lucifer was going to rebel, why did he give him the power of choice in the first place? It doesn't answer it, but it indicates that this power of choice was not unique to Lucifer.
Yeah.
And in fact, not unique to the people in a garden that happened to have a tree that represented this choice.
Yeah.
It actually speaks to the way this choice is intrinsic.
Well, I think that the story of Genesis is there to identify. I mean, it identifies a basic moral landscape, a landscape in which life has a purpose, and that purpose is its community. That purpose is a community with each other, with God, with the world around us. A giving relationship. Adam and Eve worked for the good of the garden. The garden gave back to them, and so there's a mutuality and people upholding. And you have that picture, and that describes a purpose. But within us are tendencies. There are moments where we choose options that do not lead us towards what we actually want. And there are things like pride, and there are things like selfishness, and there are things like vanity, and there are things like some of the motivations that are teased out in the story. But that's not a story that happened, you know, thousands of years ago. That's a story that's happening every day, right now, in me.
Mm. Yeah. I think that's interesting. I mean, this whole contrast between a fallen nature and an unfallen nature does raise the question then, Cam, you know, if we're saying this is so universal and so intrinsic to being a creation of God, then the way we typically tell the story of the resurrected experience, where we are saved, so to speak, in the traditional sort of Christian picture, we go to heaven.
Yeah.
Although, of course, I will point out, because Adventists often forget this when we sing hymns, Adventism does not believe we go to heaven and that's the end. Adventism actually believes we live in a new earth, in a created realm.
I'm not sure if the distinction matters to me, Locke.
No, but Adventism should sing songs of when heaven comes to earth rather than when we go to heaven.
Well, this is my next issue with the great controversy. I think we ought be very concerned with the question, when will heaven come to earth? And we ought be busy trying to ensure that as much as possible, as much of heaven comes to earth as soon as possible. And so
that's literally in the Lord's Prayer.
Yeah.
You know, thy will be done on earth
as it is in heaven. And there's an assumption that we're going to be sort of in on that. And if you say, now, where's the timeline? Did Lucifer do this before the earth was created? Or was that after the earth was created? And at what point did he become a snake? And what sort of snake was it? And, you know, what I'm trying to say is pinning down the details of that narrative doesn't help me how interact with people in the next 24 hours necessarily.
Yeah.
Unless it does, in which case I'm really glad. So our listeners can write in and see whether this picture is something that resonates very strongly or not. I had another thought, Locke, and I can't remember what it was, but it came out of the Genesis passage. Oh, it was the comment on, you know, the fallen and the unfallen state. I do think it's possible for people to exercise choice today in a way that limits their choice tomorrow, and they become a certain sort of person.
I actually think this is sort of the answer. It is conceivable for us to coherently articulate the idea of a resurrected existence where we no longer have the capacity to choose evil. And let me see if I can articulate this. If you decide to align yourself with God and his mission in the world, and you participate in that direction with God through a process of judgment where you are judging things. Mm. Is this worthy to keep, and discarding things? This has been found wanting and will be discarded in the furnace.
Mm.
And I'm deliberately pulling out some of the vocab that gets used in some of these, you know, end of times, really big, scary sounding things. Let's use that vocab and re-harness it to describe the process that's often called sanctification, but let's just describe it as the process of regular decision making to guide your formation as an entity. Then might it not be possible for God to take that to its extreme, where the resurrected experience is the nth iteration, the sort of infinite limit of this idea, where you say, okay, well, this is the thing that I was trying to be, was a better aligned creation, created being with God, and God can then take that and resurrect that life into a thing that's fully holy through and through, as a result of its intentional, of its intention. And might that not be a possible way to see what judgment really means?
Well, it's easier to see this picture in the reverse. So instead of the saved state, let's look at the unsaved state. If you in a moment have a choice whether to harbor a grudge, and you might not have very much choice, but you only have 2% choice in what you're doing. There's circumstances, and you're hungry, and there's, you know, the physiological process and all the rest. This is the problem with people who argue against free will. The people who argue against free will have to rule it out entirely. The people who argue for free will do not have to argue that freedom exists in some totally perfect sense at all times. You're quite happy to concede that under many circumstances there is less freedom than absolute freedom. But it's more nuanced than that, because you choose to harbor a grudge today. And then tomorrow it will be a little bit easier to harbour that grudge. And then soon you'll become a sort of person who naturally harbours judges, harbours grudges, not judges. And then grudges about judges, maybe. But then you'll become the sort of person who harbours grudges. And then you reach the point where you don't have the freedom.
Yeah.
And then people jump up and down and they say, see, we don't have free choice. Yeah. For those other small choices made earlier on to have any meaning, for there to be any genuine causality, for the freedom to be in any sense genuine, then there must be consequence, which is as much to say that each choice must necessarily reduce choice. Like, I choose to go on holiday to the beach. I have chosen not to go snow skiing. So to stay in this circumstance here, I don't have choice. So free choice doesn't exist. The very authentic nature of our freedom to choose must mean that what I do now will genuinely affect what options there are for me to choose tomorrow.
Yeah. I think that's genuinely true. I mean, it raises... So we need to wrap this up soon, Cam, because after all my day of driving, we're... running out of my concentration powers. But it raises the even bigger question. What we're saying, we could actually simplify elements of the great controversy and keep this part of the essence. And I'm not saying we should do this, I'm just saying we could. Some Christians have posed the question, well, is Lucifer, is the devil, is that a real thing? You know, do we have this sort of dual deity situation where the one we choose, which one we align with? Couldn't we just have Christianity with just God and no devil? And some people madly reject that. But I ask the question, how different would our experience of this controversy, this lived controversy between good and evil, between the impact of choices, how different would that be if we had a picture that minimize the devil? You know, we're saying that if it was possible for Lucifer to rebel in heaven before creation, then it would have been possible for Eve to choose that fruit even without a snake. And of course, in all this, we're following the very conventional lines of identifying the snake as Lucifer. There's questions even about that. But the point I'm making is, even just take the snake out of the equation, the fruit was pleasing to the eye and good for food.
Yeah.
every single day.
It was pleasing to
the humans
good
have
food.
To eat every single day. It was
and
there as an option.
That's I think the point of the story, and this is where the great. I'm not minimizing the great controversy. I'm saying it's a lived experience. Every day there are options to us that are pleasing to the eye and good to taste.
Yeah.
And that's just a fact about human existence. And so could I say, Locke, that when it comes to the great controversy that the devil is in the details? Or is that a bit too much on the nose? I don't know. No, I'm not even sure what I think of that. The truth is, like, I haven't resolved any of this clearly. I just feel like there are questions deeper down than the questions that we usually ask or answer with our conventional narrative. If God is a God of love, how did he make Lucifer? Let's rephrase it. If God is a God of love, how did he create a universe with genuine freedoms? What way can love, as we know the concept of love, be expressed except between entities that have freedom?
Yeah.
So, I mean, there's levels to this that I don't understand. Just for a few extra questions, Locke, can you read out the ones that you nominated from Friday's lesson? And then we might leave it for our listeners to think about.
Yeah. Look, there's one in particular, and I've already read the one about why did God give Lucifer the power of choice in the first place? Yeah. There's other parts of that question. When he did rebel, why didn't God just immediately annihilate him? I mean, we haven't even touched on that sort of idea, and maybe in future weeks we may turn back to some of these ideas. But there was a really interesting question here in the lesson. What reason or reasons can you think of for Christ's death on the cross? So this comes up in the Great Controversy because it's clearly identified by Christians of many diverse walks of Christianity. It's Christ's death on the cross and resurrection, the thing we've just been remembering recently over Easter, that is the focal point of restoring, either beginning or culminating or activating some restored connection, some resolution to the controversy. Anyway, what reason or reasons can you think of for Christ's death on the cross? That's already a good question. But it gets better. Was it only to reveal the character of God? Was it to pay the ransom price for sin?
Mm-hmm.
Good questions. If so, to whom was the ransom paid? An even better question. I think there's some really interesting thoughts to play around with there. And of course, many Christians and Christian thinkers for hundreds of years have explored some of these questions. So let's leave those ones hanging in this episode, Cam. And we've got a whole season to potentially touch back on them and see how we think.
Yeah. Excellent. Well, we hope you've enjoyed this discussion. I've got lots to think about. We hope that the ideas we share are not just interesting ideas. And if they are, they're not much use. One of the characters, Lachlan, in The Great Divorce, who's on the bus to heaven, is an expert in theology.
Oh, I see.
And when he gets to heaven, he's so disgusted that no one's interested in his expertise on theology because they're encountering God, they're living with him. They don't need experts on theology. And he's so outraged by this that he catches the bus back to hell, where he organises a Bible study, perhaps a podcast. So there's a danger in this. we hope and pray that this helps you in your walk with God and in navigating life and finding, you know, the life which is open to us. I guess what I'm trying to say is I think that there is an opportunity for goodness in our lives. Mm. And that God is trying to maximize that. And hopefully this podcast is part of that experience. As Locke said, you can email us at sabbathschoolfromhome@gmail.com. And please join us again next week.